Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
We're presented by DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app today and use code DAN for a special offer when you sign up. That's code DAN, only at DraftKings Sportsbook.
I haven't had a lot more enjoyable moments than seeing a clip very quickly of this man on The View, landing in the middle of The View and just making arguments, as he does in his book, Allow Me to Retort, that I imagine appalled everyone who was there in some ways, because you simply said something matter-of-factly, as you've said it in your book and as you said it in a segment with Billy Corbin, that the Founding Fathers was a negotiation between terrorists. These were not your words. These were Billy Corbin's words. But basically, there was no minority representation in the founding, in the documents that founded this company, this country. I said company, but yeah, it's the same thing. And you mentioned, among other things, that when South Africa was faced with apartheid, that they simply ripped up the document and started over, because apartheid is appalling. And I just wanted to have you on to talk about your book and that appearance on The View, because you were met with what? That does not seem necessarily like the audience. I may be wrong about this, where that lands delicately, your shocking claim that we need to tear up the documents that founded this country.
I thought it went off swimmingly. I was really happy to make that argument. I was sitting on The View, which is a show hosted by women, right? So it's me, a black guy, Sonny Hostin right next to me, a panel full of women. None of us on that dais were allowed to have a say in the Constitution. Nobody who looked like us, nobody who represented our interests were allowed to have a say in the Constitution or any of the Constitution amendments or ratifying any of the constitutional amendments. And for the most part, not had a say in interpreting the constitutional amendments. There have been 115 Supreme Court justices, 108 of them have been white cis-hetero males. So I thought I was in a perfect place to make the, I think, somewhat self-evident argument that the Constitution is kind of trash, right? It is not the best we can do as a society.
You were advocating basically for written documents that actually espouse equality, because they are written by people who are considered equal. It's by itself, it's not exactly a shocking cry for anything controversial, but I have found myself all the time in the language around some of this stuff, Ellie, whether it's Black Lives Matter, not giving over the verb matter. It can't, that matter, we have to make it about Marxism and something else, that when we talk about tolerance, just simply tolerating is the bare minimum, and then tolerance is rejected. I don't think you're making shocking arguments by simply saying, if America is really America or what it's founded on, why wouldn't you give people equality? But every time there's a cry for equality, I hear it shouted down with, no, you can't be equal.
One of the arguments I make in my book, Dan, is that if you honestly think that the Constitution as currently kind of written and interpreted does not include the full and equal rights of gay people to marry, of transgender people to go to the bathroom, of all of these other things, if you honestly believe that as a matter of constitutional interpretation, then why aren't you spending every single waking minute of your life trying to amend the document so that we can get to a more free, more fair, and more equal union, right? Like, why isn't that your life's work, right? It's not my life's work, because I think that we can interpret the Constitution right now to give those rights to all people. But if you think I'm wrong, then by all means, like, pick up a flag and let's go and let's change this document that you somehow think doesn't actually give equality to huge swaths of people in this country, right? I think part of the reason why people get so like about it, being my legal Latin phrase,
tightening role. Chest, crossing your arms, clutching yourself in pain, because what you're suggesting is way too blustery rhetoric. That you are offending a holy belief in an America that thinks of the flag slightly differently or a lot differently than you think of that flag.
People think that the Constitution was handed down by God, right? They think that Moses went up on a mountain and God's finger and it wrote and it's like came out with the Constitution and 27 amendments, right? And that's where it becomes important to think critically about the people who wrote that document and the manner in which they wrote it, right? We're talking, that's why I always bring up, like, we're talking about fundamentally slavers, colonists, some white people who were abolitionists who were nonetheless willing to make deals with slavers and colonists. This is not like, again, this is not a controversial position, right? George Washington, founder of the country, great Cincinnatus of America, was the largest slaveholder in America at the time of the Revolution, right? Just straight up, like the person with the most slaves was George Washington. That's why he was rich, folks. So he's kind of pointing that out and thinking like, maybe the guy who literally had a false teeth made from the teeth of his slave, maybe that guy and his friends, again, do not represent the very best that we can do as a society, right? People are like, oh, well, it was the best they could do at the time. No, it wasn't. Nope, that's not true. Like, there were people in real time being like, slavery was wrong. John Lawrence, right? Slavery was wrong. We shouldn't do that, right? You also note, and this is a point that white people really have a hard time kind of coming around on, like, you know who also knew that slavery was wrong in real time? The slaves. If anybody had asked them, the slaves would have said no. Like I said on the view, like, it's not like the slave was sitting there like, well, you know, massa, what we needs is for no taxation without representation for massa. That's this King George, he needs to be stuck. Nobody said that, all right? That's not, they didn't actually ask the people who they were making the deals on the backs of. So there were lots of people in real time who knew what the American slavers were doing was wrong. And 250 years later, we are in a position to do far better than what they did.
You say these things matter-of-factly, and there is a lot of fact in what it is that you're saying, but you are viewed as someone who is a left extremist, correct, that is blaspheming against American principles, and you are on the direct opposite side of whatever it is that's happening in this country in a race and culture war.
Yeah, I think I actually literally last week got disavowed by the White House, which is pretty awesome, actually, because I think they literally asked Biden, do you think the Constitution is trash? And he was, what's he going to say? President, right? No, I don't think, right? So I think I've been disavowed by the White House. This is pretty awesome. My positions are not actually all that outside the mainstream of where kind of legal thought is. And really, the positions that we're talking about right now are not my most extreme positions. Like the idea that the Constitution is not the pinnacle of freedom and success around the world, which it ain't, is not all that controversial. My actual controversial positions, like, you know, we shouldn't have confessions as a thing. Like, I have actual controversial positions, but we rarely get to those, right?
Can get to your extreme positions. I don't want to get stuck here. In fact, I've spent 5 minutes here longer than I would want, just because I want to talk about why you wrote Allow Me to Retort, and I want to talk to you more generally as someone who has lived in this country and has some expertise with both history and journalism. Talking to Bomani Jones last week, I was shocked that I've been talking about race as a problem in this small, tiny playground sphere for a long time, and I vastly underestimated the problem. Bomani Jones admitted that he, too, vastly underestimated the problem, and that he had recently talked to Ta-Nehisi Coates, who can go dark sometimes, and he had underestimated the problem. As you saw everything that happened in this country in the last 5 years, did you underestimate the race problem that we had in this country?
Oh yeah. And I'm on record. I've said that from where I sit, the people who were most surprised about, well, the people who were most surprised were like, you know, white liberal suburban. Oh my God, they elected a crazy man. Yeah. But then the second level of people who were most surprised was this kind of like group of Black intellectual, college educated kind of people, right? Because like we've studied the racism, we understand like the deep roots and the history of it. But like at some point, at some basic level, like going into 2016, we're like, Chad's not gonna elect Donald Trump. Come on, right? You know who weren't surprised? Poorer African American males, poorer Black males. Like literally as Trump was running, you know, my Black friends from the old neighborhood who did not have my educational opportunities were very much like, told you Chad was never your friend. And then Black women generally were like, told you about Becky. Like Black women were not surprised that over 50% of white women voted for Trump twice. That comported with their lived experience in this country. So it really was kind of my class, I think, especially, who were just like, oh my goodness. And that underestimation, I think, comes from, you know, I don't want to sound naive, but it comes from a sense of hope, right? It comes from a sense of goodness. It comes from a sense of like, you just thought that some of these things that people said to you over the course of your life, that they weren't lying about it. They actually did believe that we should, you know, have, let's say, everybody vote, right? Like in 2006, the Voting Rights Act that has been eviscerated by the current Republican Party, and the current Republican Party will not support it at all, passed the Senate like 96-0. George, he doesn't care about Black people, Bush, signed the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act. Ronald Reagan, patron saint of Republicans, expanded the Voting Rights Act in 1982. So like to go from that to like, actually no, screw the Voting Rights Act and it's totally okay to have, you know, lines and you can't bring people like water and all this, to go back to that, to go back to basically where you are in DeSantis land, that's a bit of a, you know, that'll give you some CTE. Right there, because that's a big change.
We will talk about DeSantis land because I just am perpetually embarrassed by what it is that's going on in my state. But I wanted to ask you, we talked to Sarah Ganim and some of the Pulitzer Prize winning work that she has done in investigating some of the stuff at Penn State. And we were talking about the hatred for the media. And I asked her, why do people hate you? And she said, well, they don't hate me. They hate the idea of me, the idea of a nefarious media showing up and doing whatever nefarious media does. I underestimated how easy it would be to weaponize fake news and how much people hated the media. But I've got the broader question for you. Why do they hate you, Ellie? Not your opinions or that you can be bombastic or that you're really confident and a confident Black man can be viewed as threatening in this country, but why do they hate the idea of you? Not your profession, but why? Give me the history of why so many people would not care that Trump was being racist because they hate the idea of you.
Because I'm smarter than them. I know it sounds like I'm being super good, like, because I'm smarter, right? And because they can't easily feel better than me. This goes, you know, there's a Lyndon Johnson quote, like, as long as you tell a man that he's better than another man, you can pick his pocket, right? Like, one of the benefits of being white in this society, one of the privileges of whiteness in this society, is that you can more or less walk around your life, no matter how crappy it is, and feel better than an entire race of people. That's what's on your little white privilege card, right? And when Black people show up in your life that challenge that assumption that you're better than, that challenge that assumption that the world was bequeathed to you, when you see a person like me or Barack Obama or James Baldwin or Ta-Nehisi Coates or Mike Tomlin, when you see those people anger you because it's not so easy to just walk around and feel like you're better than those people. And that's where a lot of this stuff starts, right? That's where a lot of that Donald Trump is, in, from my perspective, Donald Trump is impossible without Barack Obama, right? It is Donald Trump rises up as the proof to the mediocre whites in this country that actually the presidency is so not important because we gave it to a black guy that now literally anybody can do it. And that's how they come to supporting a mediocre, lying con man with no skills, with just no provable skills, except for in bankruptcy, to be the president of the United States. It's if you can have it, then it can't be worth anything mentality that is part of why Trump got elected, and certainly part of why so many, you know, if you've ever looked at my Twitter feed, certainly some of why I get so much pushback, right? Because I'm not, and you know, I'm one of those black guys who's not ashamed about being smarter than the average bear. I don't really try to hide that. That's kind of my thing. And you get a lot of pushback for that.
I want to ask you about the job that Barack Obama did, according to you, but I need to find out what else is on this white privilege card. With the card that they hand you, I need to know what some of the other items that I can find on this card.
Well, put like this, whatever is happening to white people, black people are getting it worse. Like that's, you know, there's the old line, like, you know, when white people catch a cold, black people catch a flu, right? So like anything that you see, it's, again, white privilege does not mean because you are white, you are doing better than every black person in the world. That's not what it means at all. What it means is because you're white, you are doing better and have less obstacles than a similarly situated black person in your world, right? So like another thing that would be on the apocryphal white privilege card, if you go into the Publix and you don't have any money and you walk out with a banana, there's, you know, a good chance that you will get caught for shoplifting, but there's a decent enough chance somebody will actually, it's a banana lender, right? If I walk into the Publix and walk out with a banana, there's a chance that I'll get caught for shoplifting. There's a chance that they'll be like, oh, you know, he just needed a banana. And there's a chance that the cops will come and shoot me, right? That last bit, that's not in the list of possible consequences white people have for stealing a banana. That's in the list of possible, not definite, but possible consequences I have for stealing a banana. And that's how that privilege works.
How do you think?
Just kids, do not steal bananas or crab legs or what. Just don't steal. Just be good.
Yes.
Just say no. Theft.
To do not break the law. That is correct. He's not advocating for that. We don't need any proof of what it is that he's alleging. But I have heard some people in positions like yours want Barack Obama to do more for black people with the amount of power that he was given. And the subsequent backlash has been hurtful, at least in part, because more wasn't done with the power when he had it. And so I don't know your opinion on this, and I wanted to ask.
Right. So first of all, let's go back to where you were with Bomani. We're like, oh my God, this is even worse than I thought, right? Because during Barack Obama, before I thought it was as bad as it was, I was like, come on, man, let's go. You have the opportunity. After, I'm just like, whoa. Yeah, that boy lucky he didn't get shot, right? Like just the whole, like, Obama always acted like he was more constrained than I thought he was until I realized maybe he was more constrained than I thought he was, right? So kind of retroactively, I was kind of more of a critic, weirdly, I was kind of more of a critic of Barack Obama in real time than I am now. But obviously, because of the field that I focus on, because of my industry, I think that the kind of unforgivable failure or the most evident failure for Obama was his lack of focus on the courts until it was far too late. Right? Trump has gotten in there, boom, 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 226 federal judges in just 4 years. Biden, first year, 50 federal judges in his first year. Obama was like 10, like just not nearly as much in his first year. And then he started to ramp up, but then McConnell took over the Senate in 2014 and shut everything down. Obama's failure and his White House's failure, to quote his first chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, when asked about whether or not they were going to be aggressive for the judges, he said, and I quote, "I don't give a fuck about judges." Like that was his actual quote, right? So like that mentality, I think, has really held has limited the what could have been some of Obama's long-term effectiveness and successfulness in this country. He never captured the third branch of government the way Trump captured it, the way McConnell has captured it. And we still kind of pay those prices today.
How much do you fear for democracy?
I mean, Dan, let's go with your family. You trace back to Cuba, right? I can trace my roots back to Haiti. There's a level that I'm not afraid of, right? like I see what's happening in Haiti and I see what's happening here. I'm not afraid that we're going to fall all the way back down that slide, right? And so I try to remember that the range that we're talking about is still kind of fundamentally better than, you know, again, where my family can come from. That said, if you look at the range of like Western industrialized democracies, I'm very afraid. One of my uncle, who's a philosopher and, you know, specializes in West Indian philosophies, always likes to point out the problem with America is that we've never lost our democracy. So we have no idea how to defend it, right? Germany, they've lost it. England, they've lost it. France, they've lost, right? All these places. And so they have a much different sense of what it takes to defend robust democracy in the old world, where democracy is not a given. In the new world, in our country, democracy has always been kind of a given. We act like it's our birthright. And so we don't really have a great idea of how to defend it from the obvious attacks that authoritarian Republicans are making on it. And so our inability to defend ourselves is kind of a huge problem. So I look at, you know, I look at Merrick Garland and I'm like, his inability to bring some of these criminals to justice is a problem. I look at the mainstream media, I think their inability to adopt a pro-democracy bias in their coverage is a problem, right? Those kinds of things are what authoritarians in other countries have taken advantage of. You know what they say, a coup that is not punished is just practice for the next one.
You must be looking at what is happening to mainstream media and newspapers and journalism and reporting and be wondering, do you not realize that we're in a fight here and the clinging to objectivity is just going to get overrun by people who do not care about your objectivity and they're going to redistrict and they're going to have federal judges and your objectivity isn't going to sound like shouting. You're going to keep reporting facts in the face of an argument that doesn't care about facts.
I feel like the media sometimes it's like it's reporting on a chess match, right? And it's like, Jim has moved queen to b4. Jack has moved rook to c7. And Jim has flipped over the board. Jim is now taking the board and he's beating Jack about the face and neck with the board. This is a great strategy, but Jack did not see this. Like, what are you doing? Like, it's not a game anymore. You've transitioned from reporting on a contained stylistic fight to reporting on an assault and an attack using the same tone of voice, using the same structures, as if it's the same story. It's not. It's a completely different story now, and you've never caught up, right? So that's kind of at 30,000 feet. That's the problem that American media has right now. They still, you know, to quote one of my favorite lines ever, they don't know it's a damn show. They think it's a damn fight, right? That's how Republicans are. Republicans are the Rocky in this situation, and Democrats are Apollo. We haven't felt, you know, we're about to get knocked out. And we don't have that level of the grit, if you will, right now to get into the battle.
If I had gone to you when you were in college and said to you, hey, in 2022, you're not going to believe this, but Tucker Carlson is going to be a thing. The collegiate you who was studying to become the man that you would become and would learn a lot about America just based on walking around as a black man. You would have said what to me as a college student if I just presented to you the idea that a cable show could be popular doing that?
First of all, you're giving Jose Cuervo a lot of credit for for what I was doing in college, right? Yeah, studying, absolutely, all the time, Dan.
I'm just talking about when you, I mean, you obviously, aspire to be somebody who is thinking critically, who is testing boundaries, who is having, you found your voice long ago. I don't know, maybe it was before college, but I just assume that that is a time when someone who chooses your path is doing some of the most substantive growing. Am I wrong in assuming that?
No, but here's a good way of putting it. So one of my real interesting early life conversations when I first started blogging, when I first started writing for a living, I had a drink with Andrew Breitbart, like the original Breitbart. Steve Bannon now runs it and whatever, like the actual conservative, I don't know what you call him, crazy person. And we were talking about our approach to media and to writing. And we were surprisingly, we completely disagreed on so many things, right? But in terms of like what the job is, one of the things that we agreed about was the need to be authentic in our writing and our columnists and our reporting, right? That the mainstream media adopts a false neutrality when they're not actually neutral. And so instead of adopting that false neutrality to really kind of not lean into our biases to the point that we're blinded, but to put our biases on our sleeve, right? To like, look, this is what I believe, and you can expect that my reporting is going to reflect what these things that I believe, and how that was really important and a key to our success. What the actual Breitbart and what I didn't kind of anticipate, and this is like, very early 2000s, right? What we didn't anticipate at the time was that something wholly inauthentic, something that was wholly manufactured, could become so powerful that we kind of would have both thought, I think, that eventually the people would see through the facade and understand that they were kind of just dupes or marks in the larger Rupert Murdoch game, right? And not only have they not figured that out, they don't care. They are so invested in it that it's like waking a sleepwalker at this point. They'll more likely to be violent than they are to be shocked back into reality. And I think that's what I didn't anticipate. It's an old saw though, right? The bigger the lie, right? I didn't realize that was really true. That if you just lied bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where you're Fox News, that it would be more and more and more effective as opposed to less and less and less effective.
Bigly, lie bigly is all you have to do. That's what would work if I went to you and Breitbart in 20 years ago and just said, what's the key to winning at politics? Just lie bigly.
Trump has open contempt for his supporters, like open contempt for his supporters. And it doesn't matter. And I wouldn't have thought that.
So the summer's rolling in. The sun's out a little bit longer, which means we have more time to do the things that we like to do. Go out to the golf course, hit the beach, play some hoops outside, anything you like to do. Miami's going to get hot. And you know what I like? A nice ice cold Miller Lite. And a lot's changed over the years, but one thing that hasn't is the great taste of Miller Lite. So what is the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite sparked this debate in 1975, and we still haven't settled it. It's the best light beer because it's crisp, refreshing, and it tastes the same. Great. Every single time. The consistency of Miller Lite, no matter where you get it, draft, bottle, can. Miller Lite keeps it simple, undebatable quality, great taste, and only 96 calories. It's the beer that strips away everything you don't need and holds on to what matters most. A light beer that actually tastes like beer. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling and always tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/beach. Or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
I want to talk to you about a few sports things. And again, I want people to know about your book, Allow Me to Retort. Let's start with the Bills stadium deal. The deal, I thought we were done with stadium deals. I really did. I thought that the last one had been made, but the Bills got themselves a quarterback, and now the Bills have got a bunch of taxpayer money going into the only thing anyone associates with Buffalo. I guess it's that and chicken wings.
There's a waterfall up there, isn't it? Yeah, 2000 wants its boondoggle back, right? So in my book, I write about the Fifth Amendment's taking clause. I write about the power of eminent domain that the government has. And they use this power often to make stadium deals, to buy the land from actually, you know, so the government comes in, buys land away from citizens, many of whom don't want to sell, on the cheap. They say that their land is a slum. They say their land, they do condemnation hearings on their land so they can get the land on the cheap. And then they sell that land back essentially to the billionaires so they can build a play palace, right? Like, and that's okay constitutionally. It's one of the reasons why I say the Constitution kind of trash. We should probably do something about that. By the way, for people who think that I'm just some crazy liberal, my position that I just stated is what Clarence Thomas believes and other conservatives on the Supreme Court. They too are skeptical about the government's use of eminent domain to then take the land and then sell it to private developers for private interest. That is a conservative position that I have just said. So, you know, wake up. But anyway, the way that happens in the bill situation is that the bills, they already have the land. I mean, I don't want to disparage my home state up here in New York, but like there's land up there to do stuff with, right? But remember, the reason why the new governor felt compelled to make this sweetheart $1.4 billion deal, I believe, to keep the bills there is because they were threatening to go to Austin. And so the eminent domain, remember, it can work in all these different ways, right? So if Texas is willing to steal land from people and give it to corporations, well, that means that New York then has to pay an even better sweetheart deal to keep their team. And this happens obviously all across the country in so many ways. It's why stadium deals are so bad, because it's kind of always a race to the bottom. It's always which community is so desperate that they're willing to give the owners, the billionaires, the best deal possible to steal a team or keep a team. Honestly, I think that the acquisition of land for stadiums should be straight up unconstitutional, and that we would be better off as a nation if we had a federal law kind of, if not banning outright, then prescribing what taxpayer-funded stadium deals could actually be. And then I'm a huge sports fan. I go to Citi Field now. Shea was a dump, right? I love Shea. Shea Stadium was like watching a baseball game in a sardine can next to an airport. That wasn't like, Citi Field is much better, but it shouldn't have come out of the taxpayer money. It should have come out of the Wilpons' pocket.
But they had been ripped off by the Madoffs, so they couldn't do that.
Broke.
Yeah, owners, those deals, once you get to that level of wealth, the sports deal in general is a sweetheart deal. But how do you feel as a lawyer about the Major League Baseball, since you mentioned the Mets, and I'm sorry about your fandom for the Mets, the antitrust exemption that Major League Baseball I don't know, should they still be benefiting from that? Should they ever have been?
So can I just say that I am like, as an African-American, my favorite sport is baseball. It's like me and Chris Rock. We're the only people left on this island, right? Like lots of black people like worldwide, like, right? But like for like American born blacks, it's me and Chris Rock. We are a dwindling breed.
And Chris Rock are the only ones at Citi Field watching a Mets game. You will look around and there will not be another black person there. It's just you and Chris Rock.
And you know, like, you know, 10,000 Dominicans, but like me, Chris Rock, and 10,000 Dominicans from Queens. That's all. Look, the antitrust exemption was always stupid. We have an antitrust act that it prescribes how companies can act. And in 1922, baseball is sued for trust violations, and the Supreme Court. This is not Congress. This is not, you know, this is not a president. The Supreme Court, which loved baseball, and there's a long connection between lawyers and baseball, rules that baseball is exempt from the Sherman Antitrust Act because they were putting on exhibitions. And as putting on exhibitions, they were somehow not involved in interstate commerce. So they argued that the Constitution did not provide the requisite regulational structure to regulate Major League Baseball. It is among the dumbest decisions in the history of the Supreme Court. I mean, not quite as dumb as Dred Scott or Plessy v. Ferguson, but you know, top 10, like it's real bad. So then it's been upheld, you know, over the years. In 1950, it was upheld again with the court, and this is a conservative argument that I don't agree with the court basically saying, yeah, we're the ones who created the antitrust exemption. But now, because baseball relies on it so much, the only people that can overturn the antitrust exemption that we created would be an act of Congress, right? And that punts it to Congress, who then has to go out and be like, we're against baseball. And like people who vote in like, you know, various places are like, we want to be for baseball. And so it just, it never happens, right? But because baseball is just straight up not as popular as it used to be, I think there was a chance to finally get that congressional legislation that would be needed to take away the antitrust exemption. Bernie Sanders, a senator from Vermont, introduced a bill last week to do just that, because one of the things that baseball is doing with this antitrust exemption is that it's allowing it to basically regulate minor league baseball in ways that are just anti-competitive and wouldn't be allowed but for the antitrust exemption. The last thing I want to say about this that's super important for people to understand, the other sports don't have, you know, football, basketball, they don't have antitrust exemptions. Okay, they seem to be doing fine. So why does baseball still need it? Well, the difference there, and I remember I said baseball is being allowed to regulate minor league franchises, right, in an anti-competitive way. NFL and NBA don't have to worry about regulating minor league franchises because they have the indentured servitude of college players. Right. So like NBA, NFL, they use college players as that thing, which the NCAA also is not subject to normal labor laws. Right. So all the sports leagues benefit from the lack of normal labor laws being applied to their minor league, you know, offerings. It's just that baseball needs to do it through an antitrust exemption, whereas the NFL and NBA have the NCAA do it for.
Minor leaguers wouldn't have to be eating these flimsy cheese sandwiches and working at ridiculous wages while taking 8-hour bus rides and doing everything else if they didn't need to keep their costs down in the minor leagues and therefore treat their resources, their investments on who it is that's coming up, like something less than human or something less than bare minimum American workplace wages and rules.
And people need to remember that these are kids. You know, so many minor leaguers are drafted right out of high school. So you're talking about kids that don't have a college education, who don't have, and thus maybe don't A, know all their rights, but most importantly, B, aren't going to have a lot of skills to go into the marketplace with, but for what baseball is providing them. It's not great what we're doing to kids here through the minor league setup. And yes, you're exactly right. There, the need to keep costs down, that as opposed to have them fight in a competitive labor market, is a key reason here.
Is that the worst of it, of the worst of the benefits, or the most dehumanizing of the benefits that baseball gets from this antiquated legislation?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Because there are people who will go like to town on like the baseball's apparel contracts and how they're able to, again, be anti-competitive on those. And like, that's an interesting kind of legal issue, but like, it's not human, right? Like, I don't care who gets to sew the patch on the jacket, right? I care much more about the 19-year-old who, as you know, the articles have been saying, can't live on a literal cup of coffee.
You covered last week the Supreme Court confirmation hearings, and a couple of different times trans athletes came up during those meetings. And last week, DeSantis here in my state decided to weaponize this as well. All of a sudden, people care about Penn swimming, women swimming, competitive swimming. They care a great deal only because a trans athlete, Leah Thomas, is breaking some records in the event. And I've heard, we talked about this some last week, the mainstream media and even the liberal left has sat out the sports issue of that, of a former man competing against women, and has allowed the other side to weaponize and freak show what is happening here as an issue about the fairness of sport, when it's just another way to harm a population of people who suffer disproportionately than the rest of us and are treated as less human than the rest of us statistically in every way. You make what of that making an appearance during the Supreme Court confirmation hearings?
Well, this again, to me, is an issue where Democrats are not doing a good enough job fighting. Right, that we're kind of ceding the culture war ground to Republicans who are making bad and bad faith arguments, right? It comes up at the confirmation hearings in a completely ridiculous way. It's not like the Supreme Court is going to decide who gets to go into a swimming competition, but the Supreme Court is going to get to decide whether or not laws apply equally, right? So they asked Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson what the constitutional definition of a woman was. She couldn't answer because the Constitution doesn't define what a woman is. The right wing tried to make it out like, oh, she couldn't answer what a woman was. No, that's not every. She could answer what a woman was. She couldn't answer the constitutional definition of a woman because it's not in the Constitution. You know what is in the Constitution? Equal protection of people. So as long as you think trans people are people, as long as you get to the people thing, well, then they are accorded equal protection of laws, full stop, period, end of sentence, right? But again, that's an argument the Democrats usually didn't make in the hearing in her defense and generally don't make in the media. One of the things that we're seeing right now with the swimming case with the DeSantis ridiculousness is that too often the people who are left to fight people like Ron DeSantis are just the trans community, which is great. There are a lot of great activists there, but there's no reason why everybody else can't kind of join in that defense. The idea that seems to confuse people is that they seem to think that by being a trans person, what you really are is just some dude in drag who wants to go run a race, which is not what we're talking about here. It reminds me of there's an old South Park episode. I don't know if you watch South Park, but there's an old South Park episode where like Eric Cartman pretends to be mentally incapacitated so he can compete in the Special Olympics where he thinks he will be just a god. And of course he does, and he just gets his butt whooped because that's how sports work. The unfair advantage that people think you have from being a man in a woman's competition does not take into account the fact that we actually don't know that, you know, what role testosterone plays in all athletic competitions. I think there was a study that says it might be a 10% advantage in a straight kind of strength thing. So like, perhaps in weightlifting, this would be important. But when you have any kind of finesse or skill, that advantage dissipates. But people don't know these stats. They're not familiar with these studies, and they're thus uncomfortable kind of defending people, which is why I go back to the Constitution. You don't have to know what I know. You don't have to be an expert on the biology of testosterone and its implication in a poll vote. All you have to know is that trans people are people. And people get equal protection. If you just know that, then guess what? You're an ally. And you can be an ally to this fight.
The name of the book is Allow Me to Retort. How did you find the writing process? Why did you write the book? What are the inspirations for it?
Oh, inspiration, you'll get this. So one of my big, and people are going to laugh at me because of where we are now in society, but like one of my big writing inspirations is actually Bill Simmons, like old school Bill Simmons, like page two, Bill Simmons, because he wrote about sports kind of from the perspective of a fan, not from the perspective of an insider, but from a perspective of an interested party, right? And I write about law like that as well, right? I try not to write about it from the perspective of a legal insider expert who's sitting, right? I try to write about it in kind of plain language so that everybody can understand it. Because, and this is why I wrote the book at all, I believe that if everybody understood the law, especially if everybody understood what the Supreme Court does, then everybody would care about it way more than they do. And at least some people, I would argue a majority of people, would be as interested in fighting for it as I am. The Supreme Court is the least understood branch of government, but just as powerful as Congress or as the other two, as Congress or the president, right? So that asymmetry needs to be matched, and Republicans get it, right? Republicans do not know civics better than Democrats, right? But you go to any Republican on the street, you can go to a tabernacle in Utah, and you can find somebody who's just like, well, I got to have my gun, so I need the Supreme Court, right? They know that, right? You go to a Democrat who's out on the protest lines protesting against gun violence. They don't know that you can't get anything done with guns. It doesn't matter what legislation you pass. You can't get anything done with guns if you don't have the Supreme Court. You can't get anything done with climate change unless you have the Supreme Court. You certainly can't get anything done with LGBTQ rights unless you have the Supreme Court. So I wrote the book to try to explain that to people, not dumbing it down because that doesn't help anybody, but in de-jargonified language so people can understand it and join me on the in the battle.
You're trying to be accessible, right? Law can be law, legalese. You run into a lot of people, and I would imagine this happens all the time, that your facility around some of this stuff can be overwhelming. And so it, I mean, dumbed down is insulting, but you are trying to make it more accessible. You're trying to make haughty American principles and history something that doesn't have to be, you know, bored with precedent setting talk that has a lot of case study.
Do you read Zach Lowe at all?
Yes.
So Zach Lowe is a former legal reporter, actually. He used to work for The American Lawyer. And I always see that he uses those legal reporting skills in his writing, right? Because like when he's explaining a zone defense, he's explaining it kind of at, there's a technical level there, right? But he's explaining it in a way that you can understand it without being a coach, right? He's explaining it in a way that you can understand it as long as you've like played 2K, like a couple of, right? Then you're there, right? That's what I try to do with the law, right? Like, yes, there's a technical level here, but I'm trying to get it so that if you are a literate person who, you know, has read Michael Lewis or read, you know, read Malcolm Gladwell, then you should probably read Chuck Klosterman, then you should probably be able to understand my book. And that's all I need in order to really kind of expand your understanding about the third branch of government and the Supreme Court. That's the goal. I don't know if I always hit it, but like, that's why I'm doing it.
You covered extensively last week, the Supreme Court confirmation hearing. Your takeaways from the way that all of that felt?
It was disgusting, man. Here's a woman who is at the top of her field, and they Republicans spent most of the hearing trying to smear her as a supporter of pedophilia based on a cherry-picked few examples. I think it was like they were focusing on 5 cases out of 575 cases she's decided over the course of her 9-year career on the bench, to say nothing of the larger career in the legal profession. And you have to, you know, cui bono, who benefits? Why were they doing that? Were they doing that to stop her? No, she's not going to be stopped. Like, she's going to be on the Supreme Court. Were they doing that to change? She's not going to change the balance of power on the Supreme Court. They were doing it to score political points in their eventual campaigns for president, because they understand, rightly, unfortunately, that calling people pedophiles and calling people, you know, supporters of critical race theory riles up their sick, vicious base. The QAnon base is titillated by these kinds of allegations, and that and inspired by these kinds of allegations. And that's who the Ted Cruz's and Josh Hawley's and Tom Cotton's of the world, that's who they were playing towards. I was grossed out, frankly, by the way they handled that hearing last week. But, you know, I wasn't surprised. Right. Because you can never be surprised anymore. The last thing that I did that I think is something that didn't get enough kind of coverage in real time. The Republicans justify these attacks on Ketanji Brown Jackson because of what they say. They said what happened to Brett Kavanaugh, what happened, as if it was a passive thing, as if we didn't all see a woman stand up in their face and accuse him of attempted rape while they were in high school in front of the entire world in a very believable sense, as if that didn't happen, right? So as if the Democrats cooked up an allegation to lodge against Brett Kavanaugh that had no basis in reality. So not only were they smearing Jackson, they were continuing their now 4-year-long crusade to rehabilitate Brett Kavanaugh without ever actually conducting an investigation into the allegations against him. So the whole thing was gross, but again, not surprising. And I don't think it's going to hurt her. We don't know yet what the final vote tally will be. I think it'll go to the Senate, full Senate, next week, I think. End of this week, early next week, I think. But I don't expect any Democrats to lose faith. I think she's going to be confirmed.
Ellie, thank you for being on with us, sir. We appreciate it. We will do it again.
Thank you so much for having me. Let's go Mets.
So the summer's rolling in. The sun's out a little bit longer, which means we have more time to do the things that we like to do. Go out to the golf course, hit the beach, play some hoops outside. Anything you like to do. Miami's going to get hot. And you know what I like? A nice ice cold Miller Lite. And a lot's changed over the years, but one thing that hasn't is the great taste of Miller Lite. So what is the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite sparked this debate in 1975, and we still haven't settled it. It's the best light beer because it's crisp, refreshing, and it tastes the same. Great. Every single time. The consistency of Miller Lite, no matter where you get it, draft, bottle, can. Miller Lite keeps it simple, undebatable quality, great taste, and only 96 calories. It's the beer that strips away everything you don't need and holds on to what matters most. A light beer that actually tastes like beer. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling and always tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/beach. Or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.